MechCast, Monday, November 25th, 2019. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Glad to be sitting down here with you for another episode of the show. Hopefully you are having a great week, had a wonderful weekend if you're just finishing that up, or maybe you're getting to your weekend. Funny thing about doing these intros is I never know when you're actually listening to the show, but glad to have you here with me. As always, we have a wonderful slate of Apple and Mac news to get into, and also some great feedback from our community. So looking through the show notes, today we're going to be getting into AirPods and how it's looking for the holidays for those. Maybe an extension of some of the changes Apple made to the MacBook Pro line recently, going to other models. We'll get into that. Also, Worldwide Developer Conference app got a refresh and a little bit of a change. We'll talk about that a little bit. Apple is bringing its media apps to another platform. They also built out a new campus there in Texas, as well as extended or started producing that new Mac Pro over there. We'll talk about that a little bit. Apple saying they don't make money off of repairs. They talked to the U.S. government a little bit, and we got some information coming out of that, and also some new products out there. Apple addressing their buggy releases, and also one of Apple's new movies looks like it may be in jeopardy of not actually being released. So we have all of that in the news, and then we have your feedback on Apple TV Plus. Also, I want to do a little bit of follow-up on old Mac OS installers, because something changed recently that I wasn't aware of, so I want to share that with you. We have a question about Time Machine, and we will round it out with a question about Apple News Plus. So a pretty packed show. I think we should get into it, but just before we do, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is CashFly. You know, I love CashFly here at the MacCast because the reality is, without them, you probably wouldn't be hearing this show right now. They are the company that helps deliver these episodes to you quickly and reliably, and they are a great company to work with. I've been working with them for years, and they want to help you with your website and your business. That's because when websites don't load, people lose interest. As a matter of fact, for each second a page takes to load, it costs a company about 16% in engagement. And of course, fewer visits means fewer customers, and that is not good for anyone. But CashFly has your back because they have new web optimization capabilities. All of your content will be optimized before it is delivered to your visitors without requiring any development effort from you. With the recent addition of CashFly's Flex Edge application platform and implementation services, their capabilities now reach far beyond those of any traditional CDN. CashFly's web content optimization solution includes powerful APIs for solving content distribution problems, on-the-fly next-generation image optimization, application load balancing, and smart asset delivery. Listen, if your website is directly tied to your revenue, and you know it is, optimize your site's content now. Guaranteed the best user experience for all of your customers, no matter where they are or what device they're using, and do it today. The good people at CashFly are even going to provide free optimization consultation for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you. Know exactly where your site stands today with a Lighthouse score report, and learn how CashFly's web optimization solution can help add 60 points instantly to your score. Just visit mac.cashfly.com. That's mac.cashefly.com right now to get that free report and a consultation from CashFly. And a huge thank you to CashFly for their support of the MacCast. you're likely not going to find this first story too surprising, but hey, teens, guess what they want for the holidays? They want Apple products. And to be more specific, looks like they want AirPods. It used to be iPods back in the day, but now AirPods are the hot ticket item. This is according to a Piper Jaffray survey of 1,000 U.S. customers. And what is on the top of their holiday wish list this season? AirPods topped that list, especially for teens. They also wanted products from vanity brands like Nike and Louis Vuitton. And so I'm just thinking, parents out there, you better dig deep into those pockets, because your sons and daughters, they want some expensive stuff. But I didn't find it too surprising that AirPods were on the top of the list. They are very popular with a lot of people these days. As a matter of fact, according to Counterpoint Research, AirPods continue to be the most popular truly wireless earphones on the market, but they are starting to lose a little bit of ground to the competition. They say that 33 million true wireless headphones were sold in the third quarter of 2019. Of those, Apple had about 45% of the market, which is actually down from about 53% at the same time last year. As far as who is coming up from behind, it is the Chinese brand Xiaomi in second place, but they have just 9% of the market, so they have a way to go to catch up with Apple with their 45%. Samsung came in third with a 6% share. Interestingly, Apple's Beats brand was fifth on the list, so they are far behind Apple's own product, the AirPods. The report also covers the period before the release of the AirPod Pros, so it's likely that Apple's share could increase in the first quarter, but we're going to have to wait and see. But certainly overall, it's looking like AirPod shipments are going to be massively increased this year. As a matter of fact, Bloomberg says that AirPod shipments are expected to double to 60 million units during 2019. That is up significantly compared to last year. The report claims that the uptick is being largely driven by the much higher than expected demand for AirPod Pros. As a matter of fact, if you do want to get a set of AirPod Pros for the holiday season, AirPod Pro shipments are already backed up well into mid-December and should soon slip past the holiday buying season. So get on those orders now, because this is the hot ticket item for the holiday season. Another item of Apple's that's getting a lot of buzz recently is that new 16-inch MacBook Pro that we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. The big item besides the larger screen is, of course, the redesigned keyboard with the scissor switch mechanisms, which Apple is giving the moniker Magic Keyboard to match its desktop model. Now we're hearing, according to DigiTimes, that Apple plans to bring that same keyboard design to an updated 13-inch MacBook Pro sometime in the first half of 2020. This would also potentially mean that the 13-inch model would get the physical escape key and the inverted T arrow key design of the new Magic Keyboard as well. The report claims that the screen size on the updated 13-inch MacBook Pro will likely not get increased. It should remain the same at 13.3 inches, although they do hedge their bets a little bit and don't completely rule out Apple possibly doing a bump up to 14 inches. That would better match, I think, the 16-inch model, you know, doing that screen size increase and reducing the bezels, but keeping the same form factor. So I'd like to see them go in that direction, but maybe to keep costs down, maybe they don't move that way. This isn't the first time we've heard that Apple would update the keyboards in other models in the MacBook line. Ming-Chi Kuo believed the entire MacBook lineup would make the transition in 2020, but it's still not clear if the new MacBook Pro Magic Keyboard designs will actually filter down to lower cost models like the MacBook Air. As far as how that new 16-inch model looks on the inside, iFixit did their teardown this week and they shared a number of details. Of course, it has that larger 16-inch display, the new scissor switch Magic Keyboard, and a new thermal architecture along with other updates. They did note that the scissor mechanisms look almost identical to the ones that Apple has used in the past, although they do note that they are slightly thinner. They also note that there is no membrane there and a little bit more space, so they feel that Apple is likely very confident that this design won't encounter the same issues as their butterfly design with debris and other elements getting caught inside there, causing problems. There is a new audio speaker system with a longer speaker enclosure containing opposed woofers on the top and bottom. Those are designed to minimize vibration, and that's been something that's been noted in earlier reviews, that you can get much more volume out of the new speakers and less distortion. A lot of times that distortion does come from vibration and moving of other components. The system also has a 3-microphone design up from 2. Apple claims that those mics are good enough to record a podcast on the built-in mics. I have a feeling they're going to sound really great, but as far as recording a quality podcast, I doubt it. I have heard podcasts where people have used the internal mics on existing MacBook Pros, and it's fine as long as they're in a quiet environment, but they tend to pick up a lot of room noise. So I wouldn't go as far as Apple does in making that claim, but it should be a pretty good sounding set of mics. Another thing noted by the iFixit teardown is that the batteries are 0.8 millimeters thicker to accommodate the longer lasting battery life. It's also likely one of the reasons that this year's 2016 model is slightly thicker than the prior generation. And finally, as far as that new thermal architecture goes, they do note that the new fans have noticeably larger exhaust holes and are higher performing, likely to address the complaints of thermal throttling under sustained loads on the older models. As a matter of fact, iFixit says that the new fan system pushes about 28% more air, through the system. So overall, the new MacBook Pro design looks to be a winner and should perform very, very well. So far, early reviews have indicated that most people are very happy with it, especially with the new keyboard, which is also a little bit quieter than the prior generation as well, which is interesting because Apple made a big point of the fact that the new design would be a little bit quieter, more stable, and all those other things. So I am still very excited and trying very hard not to plunk money down on a new 16-inch model. But every day when I read reports like this, hearing how much people are really enjoying them, it makes it a little bit harder. So there could be a new MacBook Pro in my future. We'll have to wait and see. A quick note for developers, or just if you're in Apple's developer program, the Worldwide Developer Conference app has been updated and now is just called Apple Developer. It now will have year-round updates, including developer news, videos, worldwide developer content, and more. U.S. developers can also now sign up for the developer program with an auto-renewing subscription right from inside the app, and Apple does have plans to roll this feature out to additional locations in the future. Now, don't worry, when Worldwide Developer Conference rolls around, it will still serve as the place for Worldwide Developer Conference keynotes, videos, announcements, courses, and all the rest. It's just that that stuff will be available throughout the year through the app, along with all of this additional content. So they're really just expanding the app for developers. And of course, you can pick the app up through an app update on the App Store. As you most likely know, Apple dumped iTunes in favor of separate media apps in the move to macOS Catalina. We now have music, books for audiobooks, podcasts, and TV all as separate applications on the Mac. But what about our brethren over there on Windows? They actually still have iTunes over there, and you have to go to it for your media if you're on the Windows platform, though a recent Apple job listing shows that that may soon change. Apple is looking for software engineers to build the, quote, next generation of media apps for Windows. The listing also mentions that experience with Universal Windows Platform, UWP, is also a big plus. And that could mean that Apple is also looking to support Windows non-desktop platforms like Xbox One and Windows 10 mobile devices, including, I would assume, Surface tablets. So Apple could be bringing that suite of media programs over to Windows. I think this is actually really what Apple needs if they want to grow their services business to the next level. As a matter of fact, I think they should be expanding and taking it on to even more platforms. We did see them move it to smart TVs and to Roku boxes, as well as the Amazon Fire boxes, which I think is a great first step. But expanding it on to other platforms, both on Android and in the Windows space, I think is going to be really important and key if services is really their next big growth business. And right now, everything is indicating that it is. So they really should do music, podcasts, news, maybe even Apple Arcade, although I think that would be a little bit more tricky. Certainly Apple TV Plus, and maybe even iCloud on every platform. That would really bump up and quickly expand, I think, their services revenue. And at the very least, it's looking like this job listing is an indication that they're seriously looking at Windows as maybe the next major step. Another thing related to Apple's media services is that Apple is also apparently launching Apple Music for Business via a partnership with the Play Network. This allows businesses to get licensed music to play in their retail locations. For Apple's part, they're going to be providing human-curated curated playlists and even custom recommendations matched to the individual store's brand. Businesses will be able to control the music through a special iPhone or iPad app. And the Wall Street Journal says, in fact, Apple has been piloting this program for a while now and is just recently expanding it to more retailers. Apple has had a pretty big presence in Texas for a while, and it's looking like they are getting ready to grow even further. Apple has broken ground on its new $1 billion, 3 million square foot campus in Austin, Texas. The campus will initially house 5,000 employees with the capacity to grow to 15,000, and it's expected to open in 2020. Of course, Apple will continue its environmental efforts as it builds out the campus. The campus will feature thousands of trees, plus a publicly accessible 50-acre nature and wildlife area, and of course, it will be powered by 100% renewable energy. Apple also this week began manufacturing the new Mac Pro in the same Austin facility where they began assembling the 2013 MacBook Pro back in, you guessed it, 2013. Apple and its partners invested $200 million into the facility and created a 1,000-foot-long assembly line for the Mac Pro. In total, the plant is 244,000 square feet in size and employs over 500 employees. At this point, in total, Apple employs around 7,000 people in Austin, and that is an increase of over 50% over the past 5 years. So Apple is definitely invested in Texas, and as evidenced by the new campus expansion, they continue to grow in that region. Apple, along with several other large tech corporations, is in the middle of an antitrust probe in the United States, and they recently had to answer some questions for the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. The committee wanted to know about Apple's search relationship with Google, their WebKit lock on browsers in iOS, and about their control over when and how their customers get device repairs. The device repair thing has been something in the news that has been where many have been critical of Apple, specifically in the fact that Apple does most of their repairs or requires repairs to actually go through Apple authorized service centers, and that they can't just be done by anybody that doesn't have some sort of training or certification. On that device repair item specifically, they asked Apple to identify the total revenue that it derived from repairs and services since 2009. And in Apple's response, they said, quote, the cost of providing repair services has exceeded the revenue generated by repairs, implying that they're actually losing money and not profiting from those repairs at all. Now, what's not clear in Apple's response is if they are ruling out any profits they make from selling AppleCare, or if they're figuring the costs of free repairs into their costs of doing repairs, so all of their service programs and those sorts of things. Critics have not been so kind of Apple's so kind about Apple's response, calling their statements absurd or even misleading. Personally, I don't think it's that hard to believe if you include the repair programs and everything as a whole that Apple is not really probably turning a profit on repairs, at least not on anything outside of maybe their AppleCare warranties, which are just like other service warranties that many other companies sell along with their products. So I'm a little bit on the fence on this one because I understand Apple's need or want to control the quality of repairs. They talk about a lot about safety of those repairs and just security of data and information, all the stuff that goes into servicing their devices. And I can see those as valid arguments. On the other side of it, though, I also pretty strongly believe in people's right to be able to repair their own devices. Now, that said, I've personally never had problems finding or getting parts to, say, repair an iPod or an iPhone, so I'm not really sure that comes into play. Yes, it's a little bit harder to open things up, and in the past, Apple has done some things or taken some tactics that have made it seem like they're trying to thwart or stop people from being able to repair their devices. Special screws, we know they developed for the iPhone, so it made it much harder to open them. We've also seen those incidents where they've taken things like third-party screens and disabled products with a software update, although they have rolled back on those sorts of things recently. So it's a tricky subject, but at this point, Apple is saying, hey, we don't make money off of doing repairs. They, of course, were also questioned on things outside of the repair stuff. They were asked about maps, third-party browsers, and search engines. Apple pointed out that they require third-party browsers on iOS to use the WebKit framework due to privacy and security considerations, and they used a similar argument to defend why you can't change the default web browser on iOS. For maps, they pointed out that Google Maps and Waze have been downloaded hundreds of millions of times over the last 5 years, and that they provide an alternative to Apple Maps for customers. And finally, on the search engines, they mentioned that customers can change their default search engine away from Google, choosing Yahoo, Bing, or DuckDuckGo at any time they would like. Apple has released a new smart battery case for the iPhone 11, iPhone 11 Pro, and the iPhone 11 Max. The new battery cases cost US $129 and come in three colors: black, white, and pink sand. Something new in the latest cases is a dedicated camera button that automatically launches the camera app. That same button, also with a quick press, will take a photo, or using a longer press, take a quick take video. The button also works on the FaceTime camera, so you can use it for selfies. The cases look similar to the prior generation ones with that distinctive battery bump, and Apple says you can expect about 50% longer battery life when the smart battery case is fully charged. The cases are also compatible with Qi wireless charging, as well as being able to be charged via the Lightning port on the case. Now, I know when Apple first launched the battery cases, a lot of us made fun of them with their funky little battery bump, but I think over the years it's been proven that the smart battery case is a pretty popular product, even though there's a lot of options in third-party battery cases. So I'm going to throw this out to you, the MacCast community. Are you a fan of Apple's battery cases? Have you used them? I personally have never purchased one. I have not used a battery case since, the early days of having iPhones, when batteries were much shorter in terms of their battery life. More recently, I haven't run into too many issues, although I do have to admit, recently I have been playing Minecraft Earth, which is a giant battery suck. And I know many of you who have played other augmented reality games like Pokemon Go or, say, the new Harry Potter game, you probably feel the same thing that I'm feeling right now. So I have recently considered thinking about a battery case, and I might even choose Apple's battery case now that these are available. But what are your thoughts? Do you use a battery case? Do you use one from Apple or some other third-party brand? Share your thoughts and opinions with us. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com, or even better yet, send along an audio comment. I think it's fair to say that Apple has been under a lot of scrutiny by the community for its operating system releases, and that most recently, especially with iOS 13, it has not been that smooth. If you've been watching your software updates on iOS, you probably have noticed that Apple has released about 8 updates since the launch of iOS across the various platforms, and that rate is quicker than normal. So they're addressing a lot of bugs, which is great, but it also means that there were a lot of bugs. Well, this week we're hearing, according to Bloomberg, that Craig Federighi and his team are going to try to do something about that. In a recent kickoff meeting with the company's software developers, they announced new changes in how they will be testing software. Developers will be required to disable unfinished or buggy features by default in the daily builds that Apple uses internally to test software updates. They'll have the ability to do this via a new internal process and settings menu dubbed Flags. The idea is to help early internal iOS versions be more usable, or as Apple says, livable, for testers. In the past, teams would add daily build features that maybe weren't fully tested or fully finished, resulting in builds that were difficult for the testing team to use and to test, basically making it very hard to isolate the possible sources of the actual bugs. So now they'll have a system in place where they can flag those items or use the flags to disable those features, making it much easier to do testing and find those bugs sooner. So that should help and go a long way to help reduce some of the complexity. This is something we talked about on a recent episode of the MacCast, that really it's not about the time needed to finish features as much as it is about the ability to sort of reduce the complexity. Too many features crammed into a release all at the same time, causing these conflicts where it makes it hard to pinpoint sources of bugs, or you just miss bugs and they get out into the market. So this would be an attempt to not necessarily reduce the complexity by removing feature sets, but at least in the daily builds and testing, reduce the complexity by not including so many things as you're doing the testing. So that sounds like it should help. I think they probably need to take things a little bit further, and it's sounding like that might happen as well, because in the same report, they say a new strategy is being applied to the development of iOS 14, codenamed Azul, and that Apple is considering reducing some of the new features that they have planned for that release. So again, continuing to reduce the complexity by trying not to jam so many features into a single release, maybe moving some of those off into another release. But once again, as we discussed on the last episode of the MacCast, probably a better tactic would be to move away from having this hard deadline with any kind of bulk set of features and more focus on individual feature releases throughout the course of an update. So you can have iOS 13 come out with a few new features, and then throughout the year continue to add features as they get developed, tested, and are found to be working, and then slowly trickle them out over time, again, reducing the complexity. And while that would likely be ideal, that's not really how things work in the real world, and obviously it's not looking to be how Apple is going to have things work, at least for iOS 14. They still want to have that big feature set and that big marketing push that they can have toward the end of the year, around the fall timeframe, big announcements at Worldwide Developer Conference, but it may be a little bit better given some of these new strategies and techniques. Only time will tell, but let's hope that iOS 14 has a smoother rollout than iOS 13 did. And we're going to get to the last story for the news for this week, but a quick warning, it does deal with some adult topics, so if you have smaller children listening, you may want to skip this section. Unfortunately, one of Apple TV Plus's bigger film releases that was due out this year is in jeopardy. The film The Banker has been put on hold due to recent sexual abuse allegations involving a person associated with the film. The film, starring Anthony Mackie and Samuel L. Jackson, was set to debut at the AFI Film Fest in LA on November 21st, but that viewing was canceled by Apple following allegations and also complaints that the film was historically inaccurate. The film tells the story of Bernard Garrett, a black man who recruited a white man to front his growing financial business about six decades ago in a pre-Civil Rights Act America. Recently, sexual abuse allegations came to light against Bernard Garrett Jr., the son of Bernard Garrett, by his two half-sisters. Garrett's son was a consultant on the film, had a producer credit, and was also set to be part of the promotional tour for the film, but he himself is not depicted in the film. As for the historical inaccuracies, there are also claims that the film's timeline was modified to leave the girls and their mother out of the story. The film does feature Bernard Garrett Sr.'s first wife, but he had already divorced her by the time some of the events depicted in the film take place. In light of the allegations, Apple canceled the AFI Fest premiere, and they have delayed both the December 6th theatrical release of the film and the January debut of the film on Apple TV+. They have also removed Bernard Garrett Jr.'s producer credit from the film, and he is no longer listed as a participant at any of the promotional events. What will happen with the film going forward seems to still be up in the air. In a statement, Apple said that they, quote, purchased The Banker earlier this year as we were moved by the film's entertaining and educational story about social change and financial literacy. They said that they are looking into the matter and need more time to, quote, determine the best next steps. So it's unfortunate that this film is likely not going to be coming out anytime soon. It looked very interesting to me, but in light of these allegations, I think Apple has very few choices. It would be unfortunate, though, that the performances of great actors like Anthony Mackie and Samuel L. Jackson may never see the light of day. I'm a little bit sad about this one, but totally understand given the circumstances. And on that sort of sad note, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, though, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Linode. Hey, if you're looking to put up a website, you should take a look at Linode. They offer great plans and options and allow you to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode cloud. You can get a server up and running in seconds with your choice of Linux distribution, resources, and your choice of 10 node locations. And best of all, they're giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit. If you want to set up a server for, say, Minecraft, that's what I did. That is a great option, and Linode offers simple one-click installs for all kinds of gaming servers, including Minecraft, Ark, Terraria, and a whole bunch more. But you can also set up something a little more productive. Say you want to do a WordPress blog. They have one-click installs for that, one-click installs for Drupal, GitLab, OpenVPN, and a whole bunch more. And you can get your server up and running with your choice of Linux distribution. Basically, if it runs on Linux, it runs on Linode. And most of those distributions are available out of the box, but you can also upload custom images if you want to create your own. So you really can configure whatever server you need with Linode. They feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors, and you can pick from any of their 10 worldwide data centers, including their newest one, recently opened up in Toronto, Canada. They offer simple pricing with no surprise fees. You pay for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services, and you can get what you need from as little as $5 a month for a Nanode plan, and you can go all the way up to a high-powered dedicated CPU plan. Their dashboard makes it easy to manage your Linode, and upgrading your plan is super easy. You can even add on things like backup, large storage volumes, and load balancing. If you need support, they have great 24/7 live customer support, and they offer a large documentation library if you get stuck and need to look something up. Visit linode.com/maccast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit when you use the promo code MacCast2019. That's linode.com/maccast and use the promo code MacCast2019 for a $20 credit when you sign up. And a huge thank you to Linode for their support of the podcast. We've been having a little bit of back and forth conversation here on the MacCast about how you go about getting your free year of Apple TV Plus, something that Apple is offering to qualifying buyers of a new iPhone, iPad, iPod Touch, Apple TV, or Mac. The general requirement is that you make that purchase or have made that purchase on or after September 10th of this year, and that you made the purchase from Apple or an Apple authorized reseller. As long as you've done that and you've tied your devices to your Apple ID, you should get the free Apple TV Plus offer when you open up the TV app. But what happens if the Apple ID you use to register and purchase your product is not the same Apple ID that you say use for your iCloud account or for your devices? Well, listener Avner figured out how to work around that, and I thought this was a pretty good trick, so I thought I'd share it with you.
Hi, Adam. This is Avner with a quick follow-up on the Apple TV Plus free year offer. As you suggested on the show, indeed, the right thing to do was to wait for November 1st, where the free offer was supposed to appear. Turns out that if your Apple TV or your main iTunes account is different than the iCloud account on the new phone, the offer doesn't appear automatically. What I ended up having to do was to set up family sharing, and once I added both Apple IDs to the family sharing, the offer did appear kind of automatically. When I went to the TV Plus channel, the offer appeared, and I'm now subscribed for a full year of Apple TV Plus. I'm looking forward to great content. So thanks for your help, and hope this is helpful for you and your listeners.
Hey, Avner, I think it will be very helpful. That is something I probably would have not thought to have done myself, but it makes total sense. So just set up family sharing, and even though you just have an account that is only yours, you're kind of family sharing with yourself to a certain degree. It gets both accounts under the same account, as you know, Apple doesn't have a way to merge accounts now. So I know that's a little bit of a pain point and frustration for people, but this sounds like it's somewhat of a decent workaround. I would imagine there's still some kind of hoops to jump through, because now you've got the two accounts registered to your Apple TV. Obviously, you can switch back and forth between them. In this case, I would imagine that you don't have to, because you just need the one to qualify you for the free year. And then once you're in that, Apple TV Plus is a family shared service, so it falls under everybody's account who's associated with it. So just enabling family sharing is a way around that. It may make things a little bit trickier in other areas, because I think once you have family sharing turned on, that shows up under other sections like your Apple purchases and things like that. But I would assume as long as you stay in that main account that you've always used on your devices, you're going to be okay. If you somehow flip over and use the other account and say make a purchase, those purchases will start to show up under that account, and that may get a little bit confusing. So just something to watch out for now that you have multiple accounts under the same sort of user account to a certain degree. Yeah, I'm getting a little bit confused, can you tell, as I'm talking about this. But still a great tip and great trick if you're in the same situation as Avner, where you have a separate iTunes account from the account, the iCloud account that you typically use on your devices. Something we discussed back in October here on the MacCast was how to download and get old macOS installers and put them onto USB sticks so that you can reinstall an older operating system if you want to. The problem is that Apple, typically when a new OS comes out, has been removing the older OSs, at least much older OSs, from the App Store, or at least hiding them, as we found out. If you can find the direct links, a lot of those application installers still show up. It used to be back in the day, you could go back into your purchased apps and you could see those older operating systems, but even now that is no longer working. So we talked a bit about how to find those installers, and I mentioned that I myself have USB stick installers going all the way back to Mac OS Lion, and I was pretty proud of that fact. I've got this little, you know, this little tin that I keep all these little USB sticks in, and they're all labeled for each operating system, and it's like something I've always taken pride in. As a matter of fact, I have the install DVDs. I was going to say CDs, but most of them are DVDs. The install DVDs for every version of Mac OS going all the way back to Mac OS 10.0. So 10.0 all the way through 10. Dot, what are we on now? 14? Is it 14 or 15? Now I have to look. 15, Catalina. So 10.0 to 10.15, 15 different versions. And I thought that was great and awesome until I read a report over at, I think, Apple Insider that pointed out that most of those installers are now worthless, except for the one that is macOS Catalina. And that is because the signing certificates that Apple uses on those all expired on October 24th, 2019. So if you have an older USB installer, chances are it's not working right now, because you need to have one that has been signed by Apple. The latest ones, if you can get them, are now signed and available through 2029. So you have another 10 years, but you probably want to mark your calendar that you will need to rebuild those installers 10 years from now. They probably won't be that useful 10 years from now, but there you have it. So what this does mean is that if you have an older USB stick installer with an older operating system, you are going to have to download a new copy from Apple and rebuild that. As I mentioned before, the easiest way to do that is through the Apple support article titled How to Create a Bootable Installer for Mac OS. I will have a link to that in the show notes in maccast.com. There it has links to operating system pages going all the way back to Mac OS El Capitan. And on each of those pages, there is a direct download link for the installer. Some of them download directly. Some of them direct you to those hidden or secret pages on the Mac App Store so that you can download from there. But what about versions of the operating system prior to macOS El Capitan? Well, I did a little poking around there. I was able to search for, quote, how to upgrade OS X Yosemite on Google, and I found the How to Upgrade OS X Yosemite page on Apple's website. I will have a link to that one in the show notes at maccast.com as well, so I could get the Yosemite installer. But unfortunately, I could not find links to anything older than that. So if you need to go back to, say, something like Mavericks or Lion or Mountain Lion, you are likely out of luck, at least if you want to go to any kind of official Apple website. If somebody in the community knows an official place to get those older operating systems and can send me a link, I'd be happy to share those on a future episode and get them up on my website. But I seriously couldn't find anything, and it's a little bit frustrating because if you do need an older operating system, and you might be asking, well, why would you need something that old? Many people have older Macs that they still use. I myself have a Mac Mini dating back to 2006, and its most current operating system, I want to say, is Mountain Lion, macOS Mountain Lion. And so if I needed to get a copy of that installer, that would be pretty hard for me to find. But that machine still runs, and if I ever needed to rebuild it, I would be totally stuck. So I find it ridiculous that Apple doesn't make these older operating systems available, because they're putting actually their customers at risk having to just do Google searches and go on to janky websites that claim to have installers. And as we know, downloading installers from unknown websites is a really good way to get a malware or virus. Just doing Google searches or clicking some random link on Reddit should not be the way that you need to get an older operating system installed. There should be a page, literally there should be one page on Apple's website that has the links to download every one of Apple's older installers in case someone were to need it. I don't know why they make this so hard and such an issue, but hopefully talking about it and providing these links for you help you out. So if you do want to still have those older USB installers, just be aware, because of the certificates expiring on October 24th, 2019, you are going to have to download and rebuild those. A big hassle, but at least you're now aware. Something you're also likely aware of if you've been a listener to the MacCast for any period of time is my proclivity for backup, and saying that everyone should have backup, at the very least a time machine backup. And so that's why I am pretty excited to be able to help listener Mark out with his question about time machine.
Oh, hey, Adam. This is Firefighter Mark from Los Angeles, a longtime listener. Called in a couple times before, and love the show. And I have a question. In your most one of your most recent podcasts, and even ones in the past, you really dug into our heads about backing up. I have an iMac at home, and it's a computer, and I'm pretty bad at it. Actually, I don't back at all. And so lately, I've been thinking, you know, maybe it's a good idea. You've been really plugging that into our heads for years. And I'm thinking about going the time machine route. The one question I have with it is my family, since it is a family computer, I have four separate login accounts, one for myself, one for my wife and my two daughters. When I do a time machine backup, does it include everything within all four accounts? So all of my stuff will be backed up, as well as my wife's and my two daughters' stuff, or will it only back up, like, do I have to log into my account and it'll only back up my stuff, and so then I would have to do a whole separate backup for my wife as well as my two daughters. Love to hear what you have to say about that, and love the show, and thanks for all you do for the community.
Bye-bye. Hey, Mark, that is a great question, and actually something I honestly have to tell you, I didn't know. So I actually had to look this one up. And as it turns out, Time Machine, you know, it's meant to be super simple, easy, sort of one-click install. You plug in a USB hard drive. It will ask you, do you want to use this for Time Machine? You say yes, and that's about all you need to do to set it up. And it turns out that is all you need to do to set it up for everyone that shares that Mac. So yes, it will actually back up the entire drive, including all of the accounts in the users folder. So you don't have to log into each individual account and turn it on or set it up for each person. It will even maintain the permissions for each user account. So you won't have, you know, someone in a different user account being able to go back and recover files, say, from your account. So your kids won't be able to get at your stuff and vice versa. Of course, if you're admin, you can always up your permissions and get access to other users' files. But for individual user accounts, they maintain those permissions, which is really good. So users will be able to activate Time Machine, browse back through their own files, and not the files of other users. So they do make it super simple, and I'm glad to hear that you're considering doing a Time Machine backup. I think that is the bare minimum. As far as if you do want to exclude items from Time Machine, the only way to do it is to actually go into the settings and manually do that. When you set it up, you can go into System Preferences, Time Machine, and then click on the Options button. And there you will find a little plus icon that you can click to add files, folders, or volumes that you want to exclude from the backup list. And why would you want to exclude some things? Well, typically something that you might exclude might be your applications folder, or you might exclude some system files or something like that that you know you can restore in another way and you don't necessarily need a backup for. As a matter of fact, Apple makes excluding those items even easier because in the same options dialog, there is a checkbox that simply says exclude system files and applications. But maybe you might have some sensitive files that you back up another way, maybe to an encrypted drive, and you don't want to, you know, put those onto your Time Machine backup. Now, you can also encrypt your Time Machine backups if you want to, but that's just another thing to consider. To make it easy, though, like I said, get an external hard drive, plug it in, and say yes when it asks if you want to use that for Time Machine. And it will format the drive. It will handle everything for you. And best of all, right now, I checked on some pricing. You can get a 2 terabyte USB 3.0 external hard drive for about $50 to $60 US. So it is super cheap to get a Time Machine backup running. You can even get a 4 terabyte drive if you want more history or more storage space for about $90 to $100 US. So there's no excuse for not doing it. You might even find better deals with Black Friday coming up. So I would say this is a great time for anyone to start a Time Machine backup if you haven't done so already. And I would also encourage you to back up your backup and consider an online solution as well, because if one backup is good, two is better. It always is better to have more backups, and especially you want to have at least one form of an offsite backup. Now, personally, I like Backblaze. I will disclose they've been a sponsor of the show in the past. They are not currently a sponsor, but I think they're just a great service either way. $60 a year per computer, that is a small price to pay to keep your files safe. And what's great about that is that includes any attached external drives. So in my case, I've moved my iTunes media onto an external drive, and that gets backed up by Backblaze along with my main Mac's hard drive. So backup, always a good thing, and certainly Time Machine, it will back up your entire drive, so it should be nice and easy for you to set up. And good luck with it, Mark, and thanks for your voicemail. And then finally, in the MacCast for this week, I have an email that I received from Sean, and this is something I will open up, I am hoping will open up a little bit of discussion with you. Sean is an Apple News Plus subscriber, and he wrote in to ask my opinion, but also the community's opinion on something. He pays US $9.99 a month. I believe he's in Australia, so he's paying in Australian dollars, whatever that conversion might be. But the point is, he is paying for the Apple News Plus service and noticed recently that his News Plus content still has ads. And that, to him, is a little bit frustrating. So the question was, if you are paying for a service like News Plus, should it also be able to have ads in it, or should it be ad-free? And I am a little bit torn about this, because it feels like the immediate answer should be no. That's ridiculous. You're paying for the News Plus service. You should be able to get those articles and that information without having ads. It feels a little bit like a double whammy. And that was my immediate reaction. But then I stepped back for a moment and I thought about how news and publications have always worked. Because in the past, if you're like me, you've probably subscribed maybe to the newspaper. I subscribed to the local paper back in the day. I also subscribed to several print magazines. So I paid for a newspaper subscription. I paid for magazine subscriptions. And guess what? All of that content, all of those articles came with a healthy dose of ads mixed in. And depending upon the publication, I would argue sometimes there was likely more ads than actual content. And I was paying for those subscriptions. So what Apple is doing is nothing new. And it's also valid to point out that this really isn't Apple. Apple's service allows the publications to insert ads into their content. Now, they can do their own ads, but they can also, if they'd like, have Apple insert ads for them through their subscription service and, or through their ad service, and then they get a revenue share. Apple used to have their own ad service, I believe iAd. Now they are run through NBC. But the result is the same. If you're publishing Apple News content, you can opt into Apple's ad program and they will insert ads for you and then you get a revenue share. But it is the publication or the publisher choosing to put those ads in there, just like they always have. So I still pay for Wired, for example. I get the print version. I also have access to the digital versions, both as an app and through Apple News. And all three of those do have ads in them, despite the fact that I'm paying for a subscription. So the question becomes, should paying for content in the digital age immediately mean that we have the right, or that publishers have the responsibility to give us that content ad-free because we are paying for it and therefore they shouldn't need money from advertisers? And now my immediate answer is no, that's not really the case. I think it's really up to the discretion of the content provider. And as long as it's sort of disclosed up front that that's the relationship, that you're going to pay for the thing and there's also going to be ads, I kind of feel like I don't have an issue with that. But that's just my opinion. You know, the provider can opt to have those ads, the content provider, that is, can opt to have those ads in there or not have those ads in there. And it's really, you know, their choice. It's their publication and they should be in charge of it. Apple is providing a service through which you can get access to all of that. And I think the value is supposed to come in the bundling of the content. It's more about the volume of content that you get access to for a single price versus buying individual subscriptions. You know, I can say that if you're paying for a newspaper and, you know, three or four magazines, you're likely paying more than the $10 a month that you would for the Apple News service. And again, in both scenarios, you're still getting ads mixed in with your content. The advantage of Apple News Plus is that you have 200 magazines versus maybe three, and you might have a half a dozen or a dozen news publications and get that content. Now, I have heard that several of the news publications aren't opening up all of their content to Apple News Plus, and that's a little bit of an issue. I see that more of an issue than maybe the ad thing, because you're paying for a service and you're not getting all of the content once again, it's really at the discretion of the publications. You know, with Apple's service, it all comes down to those deals. And I have a feeling it's very hard, or would be very hard, for Apple to convince those publications to drop the advertising, because that is a significant source of their revenue. And it's been levied that they're not making a ton of money off of the Apple News Plus revenue sharing. So it's a tricky subject, to be sure. I can certainly understand where you're coming from, Sean, because it feels like you're paying for something and then you're getting double hit with these ads. But I'm curious to know what you think. If you're in the community and you have an opinion on this, we'd love to hear it. Shoot us an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander and PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at BackbeatMedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.